Welcome to the Work Revolution podcast, where we believe, in fact, we know, there's a better way to work and live. And we are here to challenge the status quo of obsolete workplace practices and ideas about leadership. I'm Lisa.
And I'm Deborah. Along with you, our listeners, we're evolving our thinking about what it means to belong, innovate, and create change at work. Join us as we dispel the myths of meritocracy, hierarchy, and other bullshit practices that get in the way of all of us harnessing our full potential to make a better world.
Oh, we would like to welcome you back, our listeners. Thank you very much for staying with us through the first part of Deborah and I working together, which started in 2021. We are now in 2022. Happy New Year. Deborah, Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you too.
I am excited for this episode because you and I were avid readers. We listen to podcasts. We follow people on Twitter and we get our information from many different places. And you and I have been talking about what's the workplace going to be like in 2022. So we decided, and we're going to be doing this in five parts for listeners, what we predict are going to be the main themes of 2022 when it comes to organizations and working people. So Deborah, why don't you tell us what it is that we have been thinking about and we're going to be talking about?
Great. Thank you, Lisa. I will do that. Okay, so I'm just going to lay out the top five things that we're focusing on that we think are going to be areas of focus and should be a focus of concern for organizations and organizational leaders and what people can expect in the workplace. And then we'll come back and go through each one of them. So just to list them to start, attracting and retaining talent in the year ahead will be a challenge. Continued focus on belonging, equity, and inclusion. Number three will be working through differences and conflict, potentials for conflict in the workplace. Next would be continued focus on mental health and burnout. Not going to be a surprise probably to most people to hear that. And then lastly, organizational culture or workplace culture. So let's go back to the first one. When we talk about attracting and retaining talent, I'm also, part of what I'm thinking about when we talk about this is also what I'm going to call the changing mindset of employees, which is, we saw this with the great resignation in 2021. And you and I have talked about that and already done a podcast episode on that. So this is predicted to continue and to get worse before it gets better. So there's this shifting, changing mindset. But at the same time, some of the reports I'm reading are also predicting, now this is true in the US and in the UK, maybe to a lesser degree Canada, but I'm going to say in North America, it's true, that the economy is predicted to grow faster than the labor market. So in addition to potentially people rethinking work and the role that work plays in their life and how they're integrating work into their life, in addition to possibly more people resigning and moving around, we've also potentially got a situation where there may not be enough people for the amount of work that there is to do. So let's just start with that. Any thoughts on that, Lisa, or anything else you want to add to this challenge around talent in this upcoming year?
Yeah, well, what to me is a big question is, where are those jobs? What are they going to be produced? Like, are they jobs that produce things? Are they jobs that distribute things? Are they jobs for what we would call knowledge workers? And
so this is going to be
go ahead.
So just briefly to respond to that question, this, I think it's going to be felt across the board to some degree, but it will be felt most strongly in the service sector, hospitality sector, retail sectors. That'll be the most significant in terms of just finding people. But, you know, many organizations right now have openings that they're having trouble filling. And I think one of the challenges or one of the things that organizations need to start thinking about is loosening up what they're looking for when they're going to market for talent. You know, I've worked with so many people who have been in job search who thought, you know, they look at a job posting and say, like, who are these unicorns that organizations are looking for?
Right.
And they've had this long list of very, very specific criteria and skills that they're looking for. They don't want to hire anybody who hasn't done that exact same job before necessarily. So as a, they haven't done as much hiring for potential. And I think this is an area where organizations are going to be pressured to shift a little bit.
Absolutely. And you know, I would add to that. Well, first thing I want to go back to what you talked about, the types of jobs that are going to be available. One of the things that's going to be, I think, a challenge is that, for instance, if people have resigned from a service job, they're not going to be entering into white collar positions, right? So people who have less of the needed criteria or credentials, even though they might be absolutely skilled to be in those jobs, we haven't yet loosened this feeling or this sense that people need to have credentials in order to be hired. So maybe organizations will be looking for work, but I don't think they're going to be taking that many chances on bringing people who don't have a lot of experience. Let's say they might be excellent employees in retail and service jobs, but I'm not sure there's going to be migration up into different kinds of jobs. I'm not sure. You also mentioned the criteria that employers are looking for when it comes to hiring. And you're right, there's a tension there between looking for the perfect employee, the unicorn, as you called it, and needing to, as you said, loosen what it is that we're looking for. I mean, many jobs people can be trained for on the job. What organizations need to step away from is the precise ingredients or the recipe of what they're looking for, and really hire for people who are interested in the work, who align with the culture, who are hungry to make a contribution. And I can't tell you how often this has happened to me over the course of my career, where I look at these 17 bullet points of what's required in the job. And in the field that I work in, organizational development, if you've already figured out what it is that you need the person to do, why don't you just get people to do the stuff as opposed to hiring somebody to manage the people who are going to be doing the stuff? So I've always found that a little bit funny. And, you know, it's a real discouraging thing when you see something you're excited about, a company you've wanted to work for, you have maybe a third of what they're looking for, and then you don't apply. And so we're losing people because of the way that job descriptions are being written. So I would hope, and I would like to offer a prediction slash recommendation, that job descriptions be simplified and that a wider pool of talent be considered for the positions that are available.
Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, I think organizations are going to have to start looking at how they're compensating people. We've got inflation now too. So that's going to be an increasing pressure as well. How they're not just their hiring process, but how they're retaining talent and rewarding them as well. And there will be pressure on, and again, not just me saying it, but from what I'm reading, there will be pressure on salary increases as well, which has been not flat, but it's been slow, been really slow over the past few years.
Which frankly, Deborah, is shocking given all the profits, like the record amount of money. I mean, the stock market is, you know, I mean, it's a little volatile, but there is value being contributed and we're not seeing it in how people are being compensated. And, you know, as we've often said, people will vote with their feet. If they're not getting what they want where they are, they're going to leave. And many people now, I think, would rather be unemployed and figuring out what they're going to do next and maybe upping their education than jumping back into a job market where the salaries are not aligned with the skills that are being demanded.
Exactly. And so with that, there will also be a higher need for talent mobility and fluidity within the organization. These rigid structures and hierarchies will be under pressure to change, because organizations are going to need to be able to move talent where it's needed in the organization, and they're going to need to look internally at their current talent pool. Not always at going to market and finding the perfect candidate. They're going to need to look at how people are learning in the organization, rapid learning, and also, you know, really diversifying people's portfolios. And I think one of the best approaches to that is to let people drive it. You know, let the employees drive where they're curious. What problems do they want to solve in the organization? If you want people who are motivated, then let them pick the things that they want to work on. If you want discretionary effort, let them tell you what they're most interested and curious about. So just continued professional growth. I think there's going to be a huge focus on, I've heard this term used, it's not one that I use very often, but democratizing coaching. Everybody should have access to some form of coaching. And there's nothing better than that person being a neutral third party or as much as possible. You know, there's only so much a person's boss can do. A really good leader will have some really good coaching skills. But, you know, and there will be some relationships between employee and leader that can really thrive in this area. But employees are always going to have that lens of, oh, well, this is my boss I'm talking to here, right? There's a power difference there. And so a coach that's not in that position is just a different dynamic and a different relationship. So I think organizations will really do well also to be thinking about that form of support for as many employees as possible.
Well, you know, we used to say, or the old line was apocryphal, the CEO talking to the head of finance, you know, if and the head of finance, of course, is wanting to cut costs. And so says to the CEO, well, you know, what if we spend money on this training and people leave? And the CEO responds, well, what if we don't provide it and they stay? And I would say it's the same thing about coaching, right? So if you coach them and they leave, well, you're creating a bigger talent pool in the world, and maybe you have a great relationship and they'll come back. But if you don't coach them and they don't get the support and development and they stay, you're making a choice to not develop your workforce so they can deliver on your vision and your mission. So I agree with you. I think the democratization of coaching, and you know, the part of that is also getting people out of the thinking that coaching is to fix problems. Sometimes it is, but the vast majority of coaching starts you at a good place and gets you exponentially further ahead in how you think, how you work with other people. And so coaching really isn't, it's not therapy, it's not consulting, it's not, you know, telling people, mentoring, you know, when I was a youngster. Coaching is really about helping people develop to their full potential. And I would think, and I agree with you, that we want just about everybody in the organization who's up to that standard.
Mm-hmm. And it's really, it's helpful for developing further what sometimes is referred to as power skills, soft skills, but I think there's going to be a real emphasis in organization on teaching people how to lead, work in teams, collaborate, communicate, think strategically. That whole area has always been important. It's increasingly important. And also what I hope to see is that those skills become the prerequisite for leadership.
This is where I say, oh, yeah, because I totally...
And angels totally came down and sang, woo. I can't sing, so I won't terrorize our audience with that, but yeah.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit. There's a piece that came out in Time magazine last June, and the title of the piece was "The Pandemic Has Revealed How Much We Hate Our Jobs." And when I think about a job, to me, there are two pieces to it. So one is the thing I've been hired to do. What is the skills and expertise and my interests and the energy that I bring to it and the passion and, you know, like me meeting what it is that the job offers and me being engaged in doing the job. But that's only part of it. The whole other piece is really the environment in which we work, right? And we're going to be talking about culture, but we need to get away. And my prediction is we've started this during COVID from these kind of rigid ideas about Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, showing up in the office. I was reading this statistic, I don't have it at my fingertips, about how many hours over the course of her career a woman spends on getting ready for work, hair, makeup. I mean, I don't know if you've had this question over times in your working life. What is business casual? What can I, like all the time and energy that goes into how I need to physically present myself. This has nothing to do with the job I'm doing. So I predict that we will see, you know, whether you want to call it the, you know, we're going to stay in the soft pants and not go as much to the hard pants. But one of my predictions around talent is people are going to pretty much demand that they be appreciated and accepted for the labor that they provide, the expertise and the skills, as I said a moment ago, and not for having to dress up in a costume and perform in a role which is separate from what they've been hired to do.
I agree with that. And I think related to that, there'll be in general, more broadly, there's just a push for more flexibility in general in how we and how people work. And so I think organizations are really going to be continue to be challenged to think about the way work is structured and how they can hand over more autonomy to the people doing the work and become as as flexible as possible in terms of things like, you know, the hours of work and things like that. Because what we're seeing, I mean, the term that I've heard used a lot, is work-life integration. And the challenge is, I mean, we do see that, but people still need some boundaries. I think that's the challenging part now that I'm seeing with the pandemic is work is sort of happening in the middle of people's homes. And while there's advantages to that, and some people like it, they don't want to have to go to an office, it also can make it a bit challenging to separate from your work. You know, I know.
Yeah, that line between work and home has been blurring for decades, right? Email, smartphones. To me, in my view, the pandemic exacerbated that. And I just wanted to add one thing, and I know I cut you off, but I keep this quote on my desktop, Adam Grant, who studies work. He's an academic. I believe he's got a bunch of books out. He has this thing. He says, the Great Resignation isn't a mad dash away from the office. It's the culmination of a long march towards freedom.
I love it. Absolutely. This has been bubbling for a long time, a long, long time. All right. So one last point I want to make in this area, and I'm going to take some of the stats from Josh Berzin's report and predictions for 2022. Josh Berzin, if anybody doesn't know, is considered, he does a lot of research and writing, mostly in the HR space, but it affects just organizations across the board. And so some of this I'm pulling from his report, and I was very relieved to see that he is talking about climate. And this is it's one of the first times I've seen it mentioned in a report like this. So Berzin is predicting that sustainability and global climate change will become HR priorities. This is how he, so first of all, hallelujah, but also really? The why I say that is this is going to become HR's problem. Like, that just kind of makes me laugh. So HR to the rescue amongst everything else you're worrying about. I think that's sad and funny, but like all of the gnarly, difficult societal changes we see and pressures, it seems to land in the HR department first. And then HR has to figure out how to convince, you know, the real decision makers and people at the, you know, the top of the pyramid to take things seriously. So I wish them luck on that. But here's some of what I want to say on this. This is what some of the research is showing. So 65% of people in a recent study said that they will not work for a company that does not focus on sustainability, carbon neutral strategies, and environmental projections. More than 80% say their workplaces are not doing enough. Companies that prioritize sustainability are much more likely to be considered a great place to work, have higher employee satisfaction rates, and higher levels of customer satisfaction and loyalty. So this, I think, and especially as the pandemic starts to become less of a focus, as it starts to hopefully, you know, go into the background of our thinking a little bit and isn't so much the focus of everyday life, I think climate is going to take its place. I think climate is going to become much more of and it needs to be a conversation that we're having. But in terms of employer brand and reputation, and also client retention, this is going to become an area I think employers are really going to need to start paying attention to. Number two. All right. So the next one is belonging, equity, and inclusion. This is one that's gotten a lot of attention again over the last couple of years. And, you know, the way I'm thinking about this right now is what I really hope is that organizations and leaders will really just spend the time and energy to really just start to understand better what unconscious and unexamined bias is and how that works. There's a lot of science in this area. There's a lot of research. And to also understand how systemic issues work. And this is where, you know, the episode that we did with Jessica Nordell and her book, The End of Bias, and the computer simulation that she did to show how small amounts of bias add up in organizations and anywhere, but you know, small systemic, whether it's sexism or racism. And because I think one of the real challenges in this area is just people's thinking that, well, I'm not seeing blatant sexism. I'm not seeing blatant racism. It's not slapping me in the face when I walk through the door, and therefore it must not exist. And so if you do your homework on this and you listen to people and you look at the research, what you're going to discover is there's not these big smoking guns of sexism and racism. It's these little tiny amounts that over time can have really huge impacts. And I think until people really start to understand how this works, they're not going to be able to create the change that I think is necessary in this area. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, nary a day goes by in which we see these issues play out. You know, one of the challenges that organizations and people everywhere face is this unbelievably deep fear of getting it wrong. And it's one thing, it's easy to, you know, say we support Black Lives Matter. It's easy to say we're going to add a diversity and inclusion thing into our employee manual. It's easy to come up with some sort of corporate statement from the CEO about how diverse populations of employees are valued in the organization. But to do the work of having the conversations that examine those deep biases is difficult, and people are afraid of having them. So I would hope that, and I predict that there will be some people stepping up to start role modeling what that looks like, because the status quo is not tenable. And, you know, I mean, if you want an organization that attracts people of all shapes, sizes, colors, ethnicities, sexual orientations, gender to buy or use your products, you're going to want people of all of those dimensions in your organization who can give the intel or the lived experience. So if you're going to keep putting your head in the sand and not deal with diversity and inclusion issues or do it in a performative manner, your business is going to tank at some point. I think that's one of my predictions. Maybe it's not 2022, but I can tell you that, you know, more than beyond white men, other people buy cars. And I want to tell you a brief story here that I was listening to an episode on American Public Radio about Joe Louis, the boxer. He was really into the swing of things in his careers from the early or mid 30s to 1951-ish. And he was considered, he is widely regarded as one of the greatest and most influential boxers of all times. Now, when he retired from boxing, so he is known. He's known for his boxing. He's known for his temperament. He's even-handed. This is not a nobody. And when he retired, he wanted to open a car dealership. And so he approached Ford and said to Ford, listen, I want to do this. More and more Black people like me want to buy cars. I think I can set up a thriving business in Chicago. I think the clientele is kind of baked into where I live, large population of Black people in Chicago. And so Ford says, you know what, let's we're going to just think about this. So sit tight, Mr. Louis. So what they did is they called all the dealers who ran all the other dealerships in Chicago, who were all white men, and they basically poo-pooed the idea. They never directly said, we don't want a Black man running a dealership. But what they said is they didn't think that this was something that Ford should entertain at the time. So veiled language. Now, I'm going back like over 50 years in history. But the point I'm making here piggybacks on what I said earlier. You're losing an entire swath of, as I said, potential clients, consumers, if you're only thinking in one regard around the people who are interested in your products. And then the other thing is you might be thinking of those people, but you're using stereotypes to sell them products. I love this thing about the internet and Twitter and all these places where people call organizations out on the things that they're getting wrong. And yes, sometimes it goes beyond just, hey, you might want to rethink this. And there's some nasty stuff that's said. But one of the great, I think, democratizers of feedback towards organizations is social media. And so I would really hope that people continue tactfully to share feedback with organizations that aren't showing the diversity that is present in our society, that aren't hiring people from diverse backgrounds and aren't selling or marketing or reaching out to people from diverse backgrounds.
That's a great point. I'll say two quick things on this and then we can move on. But have you checked out the new Sex and the City series? I believe it's on Crave.
I'm feeling deep resistance to it.
Okay,
please,
well,
go ahead.
I was not a regular watcher of the other series, but I started watching this one recently. And they're just on the topic of people not knowing what to say, saying the wrong thing, being afraid. I'm only a few episodes into this, but there has been a few really funny, in my opinion, scenes so far where some of the characters are just saying all the wrong things, getting things very wrong when it comes to, you know, trying to engage with and connect with people from diverse backgrounds. And there's this one scene where Miranda's the lawyer, I think. Or you, maybe you're not as familiar with these characters. I think it's Miranda who's the lawyer. Anyway, she's going to do some additional schooling. She walks into the first day of a class, and the professor walks in, and the professor has these beautiful, long, dark braids that go down to about her bum. And Miranda says all these, like, she just starts going down a path of digging herself to a hole, in a hole, totally unintentionally, that she then has to sort of apologetically dig her way out of. Anyway, all ends well, of course, but it was just a very funny look at exactly what you're saying, where there is a lot of tension in workplaces and in our society at large around how are we even talking to one another about some of these things. And, you know, I think it does take a bit of courageousness, I guess, and just a bit of a willingness to just go there anyway and call out and ask for the things we don't know. The last thing I'll say on this particular one is, I think we need to stop placing the burden of, you know, solving for this issue on women and people of color. You know, there's got to be other people in the workplace who need to take this up, right? So unless we're going to start, and this is not necessarily a bad idea, unless we're going to start recognizing, rewarding, promoting people who take this on and are making headway in this area, it's an extra burden. It's an extra mental load. And quite frankly, a lot of people of color, they don't want to have to be the poster child of this in their workplace. And they don't want to be the one who has to keep educating people on this. So we really need to spread the workload on this.
Listen, I don't want to be the spokesperson for equal pay. I don't want to be the spokesperson for all kinds of other issues that particularly affect women, harassment, being called a girl in the workplace. Yes, it still happens. So I agree. We need to educate ourselves and not put a burden of education on people unless they are hired and paid to provide that for us. So I completely agree. And here's something that I think is going to be tricky that leaders are going to need to learn how to do. We need to learn how to have conversations when a white man who is maybe mid-career say that they have no hope of rising in the organization because of all of us who are not white men who are educated, talented, deserving of work for the backgrounds and the expertise that we have, that they're like, now, oh, what career am I going to have? I've imagined that I'm going to rise up in the organization, but now I can't. Leaders need to have conversations with white men who are publicly, or maybe not publicly, water coolery or in their Zoom calls, saying these kinds of things, because this is not about taking opportunities away from white men. This is about enlarging our scope of what we know a talented workforce is and providing the opportunities to people who can do meaningful, important work, regardless of the bodily shape, form, brain, you know, whatever we've come, the package that we've come in. You know, let me just repeat what we learned from Jessica Nordell in one of our episodes. 50% of the top 10 Fortune 500 companies have white men over 6 feet tall, but this only represents 5% of the population. We want the richest diversity we can, and leaders are going to need to step up both beyond their fears. I predict some of them will and will role model, and they need to learn how to have the difficult conversations. And I do feel we're leaning in that direction. So I'm a little soapboxy on this one because it needs to happen. And for those who aren't doing it, step aside and let those courageous leaders move forward and help people have these conversations.
Which segues amazingly into the next one, which is managing through conflict. So now I've seen a little bit written about this. I haven't seen it written a lot about, but I think this is going to be an area of focus because all of the prickly issues that we've been talking about and even what the pandemic has brought to light, as people maybe come back into the workplace, going back to work in a physical way, into a space, there's going to be a lot of really challenging issues and things to talk about. And so I'll use the pandemic as an example. And I've seen this play out even in my personal life. The pandemic has almost become similar to politics and religion, like one of those topics where you're not sure you should bring it up at the dinner table. You know, you're sort of thinking, unless I really know where someone sits on this one, there could be some contention, right? And so as we begin to move forward in the world of work and we think about how our workplaces will be structured, you know, whether people are vaccinated or not, there's just so many things that this diversity, equity, inclusion, huge area where people need to be able to talk about things that they disagree on. But I think it is really important that organizations have very clear standards around respectful conduct in the workplace. And that I'm not overall a fan of a lot of rules, a lot of regulations and policies. I think in general, we want less bureaucracy and more freedom and mobility. But around standards of conduct about how people are spoken to and treated within the workplace, I think that is something that needs to be held to a very high standard and needs to be applied to everybody equally in the organization, no matter what level you're at. We have seen a lot of examples of really bad behavior. We've seen it in government. We've seen it in workplaces. We've seen it in a lot of different spaces. And I just don't think we have a hope of moving forward in a meaningful way if people can't talk about their differences in a respectful manner.
I'm glad you started off mentioning COVID, because whether it's distancing or masks or hand sanitizing, and you mentioned vaccination status, you know, most of us are pretty clear on what we're committed to doing and the stance that we've taken vis-a-vis all of this. And being around people with different views has been triggering conflict on this from the start of the pandemic, right? And, you know, let's not forget, we're all a little maxed out right now. You know, there's on the continuum of maxed out to effing maxed out, to use that technical term. We are our cognitive and our effective emotional loads that we're carrying are heavy. So before, where something might have been an annoyance and something you disagreed, you don't like the smell of somebody's lunch, now we're in a whole other realm. And so our ability and our resiliency to deal with conflict is a little shot, and we're dealing with, you know, values around health. Now, I just wanted to talk a little bit about this idea of conflict, because we have never been great at living with conflict and having conflict in the workforce or in the workplace. And years ago, when I started off in my career, I was, you know, you're given like things you're going to teach. And I was asked to teach a module on conflict resolution. And I quickly learned, probably in, you know, half an hour into it, that many conflicts cannot be resolved. We're talking differences of values, right? Just like we were talking about briefly around vaccination status. And so really what you're helping people do, the best that I thought I could do, was help them manage these differences, right? How do we manage the conflict so we can live with it? And, you know, when I was doing this work, I realized I grew up in a family where there was never any overt conflict. I never learned how to be in a difficult conversation with someone. I learned that much later in life. But one of the things that I learned was if there was something I disagreed with, was to keep my mouth shut, as opposed to learning how to engage. And so for me, what I predict as we step into this, and again, leaders are going to have to play a role, is how to engage productively in conflict, how to not necessarily scream and slam doors and, you know, run away from open concept desks that we never really liked in the first place, and be able to engage in a conversation. And if you can't resolve something, there are ways of working through things. But here's the other thing. They're managing, living with, engaging with conflict is beyond a set of techniques, right? What we're actually looking at is how do we step out of this thing that we think of conflict, working with conflict as an organizational thing. This is our life's work in some ways, right? This is personal development. And in order to be good at conflict, we have to understand our own relationships to conflict, right? Are we avoidant? Do we need to win at all costs? Because we have some problems we all need to solve together. Yes, we're going to have differences. Yes, there's going to be friction and we're going to rub up against each other. But learning how to engage respectfully in conflict, and again, it could be related to race or sexism, is going to be really, really important. And we need to start there. We need to start with ways that we can identify our own behavior. And I encourage people to really take a serious look at, do you want to live the way you live with conflict, either being avoidant or being a fighter? And is this going to help you and your organization get to where you want to be?
So a couple great resources for this. One is the work around psychological safety. And this is based on the work of Amy Edmonston, who originally coined the term, and she's a Harvard Business School professor. And another interesting thing potentially for listeners to look at if they're interested is a research study that was done by Google called the Aristotle Project in 2012, where they looked at creating a psychologically safe work environment and the differences that that made in their business. So I won't spend a lot of time talking about that, but that's a couple areas to dig into further. The other person I want to mention who's doing some really interesting work in this space is Priya Parker. And she wrote a book called The Art of Gathering. And Priya, it's P-R-I-Y-A, priyaparker.com. We're going to put all this in the show notes, has some really interesting guidebooks for gathering. And, you know, I heard her interviewed on a podcast, which is what started me going down this road of thinking about, when we start to gather together again, what's that going to look like? There's going to be all this awkwardness, even just in how we greet people now. Is it changing, or how is our behavior going to be changing? And she's got a guide around both in-person meetings and virtual gatherings that can be helpful. All right. So number four on our list is, this one, mental health and burnout, again, exacerbated by the pandemic, right? Because we've just seen a lot of, and again, we were going down this path already. You know, our culture around work was already problematic in this area. And now we've really shone a light on, this is a big, big problem area. So I'm going to tee this up, Lisa, and I think it's going to send you off to something that I think you're on the same page with me about. Yeah. Get ready to start freaking out.
Deborah, that's the nicest thing you've ever said to me. You're going to launch me into yet another soapbox moment. I'm ready. Bring it on.
You and I, one of our pet peeves, right? This is not about covering people's chiropractic bills and, you know, having someone come in and do a workshop on mindfulness. This is about looking at your workplace practices. What is causing people to be stressed out and burning out? Looking at your day-to-day practices, whether they are actual like policies and practices or the unspoken expectations in a workplace.
Listen, mental health is mental illness, mental health. These have been issues forever. Right? The human beings are complicated. Sometimes there's things that don't work 100% with our bodies. Same thing with our brains. And so because of that, mental health problems and issues in health have also been a part of the workplace, but mostly hidden because of stigma. And vast majority of people who struggle with these issues manage very well on their own, sometimes with the support of EAP programs in the workplace, but mostly people digging into their own pockets, getting therapy, getting the right kind of medical help if they have a condition, a mental health condition that can be supported through the use of medication. But you are absolutely right. What is different now? Well, the pandemic did two things. One is it added, as I said a moment ago, to the load that we all carry. So we are frying out at a faster pace than we would before. But the other is when you look at what is causing all this stress and mental burden and emotional, pain, it's what's being expected of us and demanded of us from the workplace. So now we're really seeing and understanding that the workplace is one of the main causes of the mental health challenges. And burnout right now is because of how we've been living and what is expected of us from work. Okay, we've got all this other stuff going on that we're trying to manage, but we're trying to manage it in addition to these workplaces that are uncompromising in the demands that they place on us. I mean, look at the beginning of the pandemic. The sales of computer software to monitor how many clicks on people's keyboards, software that could take a screenshot of your screen at any given time during the day if your mouse wasn't moving. And so these are maybe the more extreme examples, but they're relatively prevalent. I don't know how many people I've talked to over the course of the pandemic that suddenly they had to be at 8 o'clock meetings with the team or with their boss, just to make sure that they were up and dressed, at least from the waist up, and ready to work, right? Issues of trust around all of this. These put an excessive burden on people who are already trying to manage some very complex situations in their personal lives, in addition to all the stuff we've talked about in terms of people's different values around COVID protocols. And so, here's the crazy thing in all of this. Productivity's gone up, but the price that we've paid for it is this unsustainable burden on people's mental and emotional capacities. Organizations will have to deal with this, or people are going to keep walking out and not coming back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And this is why, this is in large part why we're just kind of going back to the first thing that we talked about, which is people reevaluating the role that work plays in their life and how they're going to be integrating it. And these things are connected, absolutely. I'm going to say one other thing about this area, about stress in particular, because stress has almost become like smoking, right? It's we know that there are huge health implications to stress, and especially ongoing stress. And we do have an overwork culture in general. So this is where we need to start addressing this culture around working long, hard hours, which, by the way, rewards unencumbered people, you know, the people who can put in the time because maybe they have less demanded of them outside the workplace. And that doesn't lead to having necessarily the best or most talented people on the job, but just the people who can put in the most hours. And we don't really want that to be the criteria for success or elevating and, you know, moving up in an organization. I just want to talk a little bit about stress in our brains for a moment, just to explain this a little bit without going into too much detailed science on this. But it will lead me to, I hope, being clear about why this is so important. So there's two parts of the brain that I'll just make a mention of. One, first of all, the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of our brain that is involved in what we would call more higher thinking, decision-making, problem-solving. It also is where our working memory is contained. This part of our brain and the workings of this part of our brain actually require a lot of energy. This part of our brain uses up a lot of brain glucose and oxygen. So it's tiring to work this part of our brain. So that's an important point to make. So, you know, the 8-hour day, this part of our brain's not putting in 8 hours a day. Let's just put it that way. It's also really sensitive to the neurochemical environment. So it's really sensitive to what's happening around us, which is potentially coming from this other part of our brain. So the limbic brain or emotional brain, and this is where our fight and flight mechanism is contained. Now, the prefrontal cortex is the most evolved part of our brain. So the limbic brain is older, but still plays a really important role. It's always scanning our environment for threats because ultimately it's there to help keep us safe. And these threats, by the way, are real or perceived threats, which is also an important thing to remember. Now, the threats nowadays, you know, we don't very often get threatened by lions and tigers and bears so much in our day-to-day life, but we can feel like we're being chased by lions and tigers and bears because of other triggers that can still trigger this threat response. And when we're in that state, and stress and ongoing stress is that state, we rely more on habitual behaviors. So change is even harder. It reduces our access to the resources that are available in the prefrontal cortex, decreases perception, cognition, creativity, ability to collaborate. Therefore, reducing stress, staying out of stress, actually makes us better problem solvers, better decision makers, better at collaborating. We do better work when we're not in that state. And so there is a huge organizational benefit to having leaders and employees not be overly stressed. And this is also why there is so much research now showing that, you know, happier employees are actually more productive. They do better work. So I think it's going to be, you know, incumbent on leaders to really start to think about how can we not just be giving people, you know, things that they can do outside of their workday to help manage their stress, but how can we be changing how we work and the culture around work so that it's less stress inducing. And I can provide a quick example of that because you mentioned meetings. So one really quick example, do we need to have meetings all hours of the day? Should there be some parameters? Can a workplace maybe have some, and some organizations have done this, but should we have times of the day when there's no meetings allowed? Should we say that, you know, you can't book a meeting certain times of the day or certain days of the week, we're going to be meeting free? People are sitting on virtual meetings like hour after hour throughout the day. And it's actually shown to be even more exhausting.
Just talking about meetings exhausts me.
I know, I'm getting stressed thinking about this.
Am I ever have to be in another meeting?
You know what's stressful? Leading the work revolution, Lisa. That's really stressful.
Yeah, it is. It is stressful. But thankfully, there are not that many meetings involved in doing it. That's one thing we've already worked out. All right. So we've got one more item that we want to cover. And this is around culture. So Deborah, what have you got on culture?
Well, you know, my segue, I'll take it from where I just left off, which is how can we create a work culture where, you know, we can keep people in this more positive, stress-free state? I mean, I think the best thing that we can do from a culture perspective is think about how can organizations create, you know, help people feel like, because our feelings matter, right? Our feelings inform whether we're in this stress state or not. How can we create more feelings of appreciation and being cared for, loved? How can we have more humor? How can we make sure that people feel a sense of accomplishment, confidence, happiness, pride in their work? And the more that these feelings can be generated, the more that I think we're going to see the kind of organizational cultures where people, A, want to work, but also are going to be able to produce great results.
Well, you know, I've stolen this line from you, and I haven't always credited you for it, but I am crediting you with it now. When you talk about leaders being science deniers, I worked in healthcare for decades. I worked in, you know, fields in which everybody's following the evidence base, except we have this huge evidence base, as you just described, on how the human brain works and what people need in order to be productive and creative. And we just seem to flush that all away and metaphorically crack the whip. So I don't like that. And I know that many organizations are realizing that if they don't follow the science on the brain, on cognition, this is separate from personality, right? This is separate from all of that. This is about the literal functioning of the brain. The more we follow that science and listen to what's coming out of this field, the better we're going to be able to lead organizations and the cultures within them. I just have a couple of things that I want to finesse a little bit in this part about culture. So I often, in the work I do, people ask me, help me understand why culture is so important. So let me just give a little Coles Notes version on this. So strategy, right, is what guides the work. What are the priorities that we have? What are we going to do in order to realize our vision, right? So what is the things that are actually going to happen? These could be the goals we're going to set, the processes we're going to put in place, and the activities we're going to do on a daily basis. The what? Culture is what drives the work forward. It's the how, right? And you talked about mindsets earlier. It's the motivations. It's how people express and contribute, the way they show up in order to drive the mission and the vision. These are the values, the behaviors, the practices, right? i.e. meetings, right? If you want to have a healthy workplace, you're going to do the things, you're going to have practices around meetings, you're going to be articulating what it is that you want to have happen in these meetings, and you're going to do healthy work practices that protect the human brain. That is a big part of what culture is. And by the way, strategies, as fantastic as they are, they don't do themselves. It's the people who do the work together, and they need environments and practices that need to reinforce healthy, candid, conflict-positive ways of working so that we can get the important things that we need to do done. You know, we've heard this thing that, what is it, culture eats strategy for breakfast. I think, and my belief is, the organizations that wake up to the fact that your culture is your strategy, that if you don't focus on the people who are, you know, creating the work, creating the value, you are not going to advance in this future world. People are, as you know, whether it's they're resigning, they're rethinking their careers, they're relooking at their priorities, no one is going to be interested in your crappy job that does not take into account the brain that they bring and the heart that they bring. And this is where I predict that people will become a little more vocal about making demands on the types of workplaces and the work environments that they want to work in. We do have one structural problem, is that we've tied in our society income to our jobs. Well, we work for money as part of what we do. But what that does is it often silences us. It prevents us from bringing our best work, because if we say something or we upset somebody's feelings, our jobs are in jeopardy. We're going to need to figure out how to decouple this in some way where that people can be fairly confident that their jobs are not on such a fragile plateau if they're bringing their most creative ideas, which might go counter to what the boss thinks the best ideas are. So I'm like, culture is my thing. And I, if anybody, you know, really wants some advice and some help on this, we have an Ask Us Anything that we're happy to talk about these issues further. But I absolutely agree with you, Deborah, when you talk about, you know, brand, reputation, purpose, like that's important. People are going to want to work for companies in which the culture is important. And I'm not talking foosball tables and, you know, beer on Fridays. I'm talking energizing, important work that taps into the best that we have to contribute.
100%. Yeah. So I think the theme that goes across all of these things, and the theme that has been talked about actually for many years now, probably to the point where some people have been sick of hearing about it, is just change in general. I feel like, you know, this idea of being resilient to change, open to change. But here's the big shift that I think I'm seeing right now. If I'm looking through my crystal ball and reading the tea leaves, as I like to say, I started hearing a lot about change over the past probably decade or so. I don't know if you would agree with that, and it was a very top-down message from organizational leadership that we need to change. People need to change. We need to be, you know, resilient to change because, you know, businesses had to be more nimble and agile and competitive and so forth. But the difference that I'm seeing now is that change is bubbling up. I think organizations and leaders are now faced with a different viewpoint where they are being asked to change. Organizations are being asked to change in response to what they're hearing broadly in society and from their employee base. And that this is putting a pressure on organizations that I don't think we've really, certainly during my career, I haven't seen this or felt this in the same way. And so the more that organizations can be open-hearted, open-minded, and they themselves showing that they can be resilient to change and can be agile is going to be really important for success moving forward.
Yeah, I was reading this thing just this morning about thinking differently about change exactly in the way you described. There is no answer. And so this idea that, okay, a leader's going to have a little group of people and we're going to figure out what the problem is. We're going to come up with a solution. We're going to implement it. And that's change. What I love about what we've learned about from the agile community is let's just invite everybody to hack the issue. There are great ideas everywhere, right? Just because you happen to have a director or VP title does not make you a better person at coming up with some of the really meaningful, juicy solutions to the problems that are plaguing us at work and in our society. So I want to say that. And I do want to end by saying this one thing. You talked a moment ago about crystal ball and tea leaves. In the event that anyone thinks that I'm a flake, please go ahead and think that. But I did pull a tarot card right before the beginning of our podcast. And I ended up picking the Two of Pentacles. And I'm just going to read to you what the Two of Pentacles is cause for jubilation. Troubles not as serious as imagined. So I'd like to leave our listeners on that note, that everything we've talked about here and all the systems that do not work for us, they were constructed and they can be dismantled and replaced with far better things that help us move these five issues and many others forward. So I look forward to the jubilating at the end of 2022, knowing that there's still going to be work ahead.
That's a great point to end on. And all of our work is also through the lens of what we want ultimately is a better life for everybody. We want more joy in our lives. We want more community. We want a great sense of belonging. And we want to live peacefully and sustainably on our planet, as I've said before. And so this is something, and that is going to require rethinking and changing the way we do things. But the good news is that we're really capable of doing that. We just need to make sure we involve everybody in that process. So that's it for today. We'll see. We'll have to do a recap at the end of this year and see where, you know, right and wrong about some things. Reminder to our listeners, please, you know, we'd love to hear from you. So get in touch with us. You can get in touch with us through our podcast website, workrevolutionpodcast.com. And if you're having a challenge at work, we'd love to hear about it because one of the things Lisa and I would really like to do is start talking about just real life issues that people are dealing with. And we're going to keep those episodes pretty short and sweet, I hope, so that, you know, you can power through a bunch of them if that's what you'd like to do. Those will be also available on YouTube. And yeah, we're looking forward to hearing from some folks. And that's it for now. Until next time.
Until next time.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you're hearing, please subscribe and give us a review. And follow the Work Revolution podcast on Instagram for more great content and updates about our work.
In addition to two full episodes a month, we have a monthly Ask Us Anything, where we answer your questions about leadership, career maneuvering, and whatever workplace challenges you're facing. Submit your questions to our website at workrevolutionpodcast.com, where you'll find all our episodes as well as learn more about who we are.
Thanks to Bernie at Blue Eye Music for our music theme, and to the team at Podatize for production support. Until next time.